The good life is one inspired by love and guided by knowledge. You'll find both love and knowledge here on The Misdiagnosed Life. Here is your host, Beverly Butler.
We're seeing an epidemic in this country of ADHD, autism, and all kinds of these neurobehavioral problems. But the question on my mind and on other people's mind is, what is really causing these neurobehavioral problems? Because unless we know what's really causing them, we're not going to be able to fix them. You know, I wonder, does it start with the brain? Does it start with the body? You know, a lot of people have different ideas, and I think maybe they're all right. I don't know. I'm really excited about the guest I have on today, because he deals with this every day, and he works with children with these neurobehavioral problems. Now, his name is Dr. Robert Melillo, and he's a world-renowned chiropractor, neurologist, professor, and researcher in child neurological disorders. He's also the creator of the Brain Balance Program, and he's also the author of four books, Disconnected Kids, Reconnected Kids, Disconnected Kids Nutrition Plan, and Autism. Now, he's had a lot of success in working with these children, and I'm really thrilled to have him on the show today and to talk about this problem. Dr. Melillo, welcome to the show. And I wanted to ask, what do you think, since you deal with this every day, what do you think is really at the root cause of these neurobehavioral problems?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say right off the bat, I'm very happy that you actually use the word epidemic. There are so many people in this country that are afraid to use that term. And deny that we actually have a huge epidemic going on with these issues, and especially with our children, and now actually even getting into young adults almost as much as anybody at this point, because they've never been dealt with. And really, it comes down to two things: understanding exactly the question you just asked me, which is what is actually happening in their body or in their brain, and what could cause that. Because, you know, ultimately that means that if there is some sort of environmental factor that's driving this, or factors that's driving this, then it becomes something that we can actually prevent, which is really the only way to really make a huge dent in an epidemic, right?
Right.
So that's really what it comes down to. So, you know, one of the things we'll go on, we'll talk about, you know, what actually is happening in the brain. But in my book, Autism, the Scientific Truth, in the first chapter, I take on the idea, is this actually an epidemic? And I did show, I think, in there clearly that we are facing an actual epidemic. And we can go through those numbers. They're staggering. But what I also showed was that it could not be genetic. It could not be driven by genetic mutations, because there is no such thing as a genetic epidemic. Changes in genetic mutations take generations and thousands of years, and generally the ones that survive are the ones that actually are advantageous, not ones that aren't necessarily advantageous. Also, the fact that virtually, you know, no parent of a child with autism has autism. Virtually, you know, very few parents of kids with these neurobehavioral disorders actually have those disorders themselves. They may have variants of it. So, again, if these were genetic, so if it's not genetic, if it cannot be a genetic mutation, then it must be environmental. And in my book, I identified about 50 of the most well-documented in science, the most well-documented environmental factors that elevate the risk of having a child with autism or some other type of neurobehavioral issue.
Just briefly, Liz, just tell us what three or four of those things are. I think many of us know what some of them are, of the environmental factors.
Sure. One of them is age. And by the way, these environmental factors affect both men and women. And they affect really the parents of the children more than the children themselves, because most of these issues start prenatally, meaning they start in the womb. We know autism and ADHD, schizophrenia, almost all of these are pretty well documented to start in the first or second or third trimester. But actually, they really are believed to start what we call preconception, meaning that although these are not genetic mutations, what's happening is that the genes of the mother and the father are turned off when they get pregnant or as they're looking to get pregnant. And those genes that are turned off can be passed on that way to children. And a gene that's turned off can look just like a gene that's mutated later on in life. So when we look at it, one of the things is age. There's been a huge difference in the age of having children. In the 70s, the average mother of a first child was 21 years old. The average male was 23. Now it is 32 and 35. So we're looking at fathers are 15 years older now, at least, than they were in the 70s or 80s. And what we see is that the majority of children being born are being born to the older parents. We also see, basic overall health. We know that, for instance, if a woman has either diabetes, obesity, or high blood pressure, any one of those three factors elevates her risk of having a child with autism or neurobehavioral disorder anywhere from 60 to 150%. So if you have a woman who is obese, has hypertension and diabetes, which usually the three go together, you're talking about almost a 500% elevated risk of having a child with a neurobehavioral disorder of some sort. What we look at is, again, going back 20, 25 years ago, the amount of women that were overweight or obese at the time of their first pregnancy was only around 20%. Now it is almost 60%. So those are some factors. Obviously, there are a lot of other factors. There's factors like pesticides, chemicals in our environment, the use of drugs, whether the mother has a flu virus or not during pregnancy. That seems to be a pretty big factor. Things like autoimmunity, things like gluten sensitivity. But to me, one of the biggest risk factors that really is unexplored is what I deal with all the time are brain imbalances, the thing that really is at the root cause. This is what actually is happening in the brain of a child with autism or ADHD or dyslexia. And those imbalances, if they're present in the mother and or the father, that can be passed on to their child. And to me, that is one of the biggest risk factors that nobody talks about.
Wow, this is really interesting. And you're touching on some things that I've not seen, and I'm not saying they're not out there, but you just don't hear much. I've not been hearing this from anybody else. So some of these things. Now, some of these things, we have are more well known. But I wanted to go back just a minute. You said there are some genes that are turned off. Now, what genes are turned off?
Good question. And, like you said, first of all, yes, you probably haven't heard a lot about this because one of my biggest missions is to raise awareness and to get the media to start being aware and talking about this stuff and recognizing there are millions and maybe tens of millions of families out there struggling with these issues. And they feel like they're ignored, they're isolated, they're alone. They feel like nobody cares about them because nobody's talking to them, really. Nobody seems to be concerned with them. And if there is anything in the media, it's only basically to point out how miserable, their lives are and not to give them any real tools or any hope.
Right. So, that is a big problem.
It is a big problem. And part of my mission is to really go out there and really raise awareness in the media and also go out there and let people know that there are people like me out there that really care about them and that we're going to do it. And we're going to get people out there to recognize it. My wife and I are working on our own TV show at this point to try to, go out there, but to really give people tools and really show people that there's hope and that most of these problems can be completely corrected. So the genes that we're talking about is 85% of the genes in our 25,000 human genome are there really to build our brain, primarily during early child development. And to, maintain our brain and to also, the fact that we have something called neuroplasticity, which means that we can always grow new connections. We can always learn new things. Our brain, can always change based on our environmental experiences. And this is, goes back to a lot of those genes. So because those genes are by far the most prevalent genes we have, those are the genes that most commonly seem to be turned off. This is what we call epigenetics. It's the difference between genetic mutation or what's called an epi mutation, which means that it's not about necessarily genes being damaged. It's really about what genes are actually turned on or turned off. And what we find is that more often than not, it's that these certain genes are turned off when they should be turned on. They're turned off by chemical factors. They're turned off by stress hormones in our body, cortisol, inflammation. All of those different things can attach themselves to genes. And what they do is they produce what we call methyl molecules. And these methyl molecules will attach itself to segments of DNA. And this is known as DNA methylation. And it prevents that part of the gene from being read. And so therefore, it's as if that gene never existed. And that's what we see. And so the ones that are connected or affected are the ones that are mostly responsible for what we call functional connections in the brain. And that is really where all the research right now is going. The idea that all of these issues are really come down to a problem with what we call functional connectivity.
Wow. That is really, really interesting. So basically, are you basically saying that the stressors that we have within our bodies, like the cortisol, stress hormones and stuff, and also the chemicals and things in our environment are actually going in and basically turning off the genes?
Yes. Yes, exactly. And you know, so when you look at it, all of these chemicals, all of these stressors that we have in our life, obviously stress itself, all of these different things, what they do is a couple of different factors. One is mainly our lifestyle is not creating a healthy body and a healthy brain. The fact that we're so sedentary, all of the things that are driving the obesity, diabetes, heart disease epidemic that we find in adults are all the factors that are driving them in child development. Because in adults, you know, after your brain has been built, mostly in childhood or in adolescence, then, you know, your major risk is going to be when you have an unhealthy lifestyle, it's going to affect your body and that affects your brain. But, you know, so people will end up with things like diabetes and cancer and heart disease. But in a child, you know, what the main thing that's happening is their brain is being built. And so therefore, the main thing that it shows up in kids is learning challenges or behavioral issues. And that's what we see. So the fact that, you know, I think this all really kind of started with the development of the personal computer and how that changed our lifestyle. There's never been as dramatic a change in human lifestyle as there has been over the past, you know, 30 years because of computers and technology, and it's getting more and more and more. And so what we see is that it's affecting the adult body and it's making us more unhealthy. It's actually causing more of a stress reaction in our body so that our bodies, you know, the average human is walking around looking like their body is completely stressed out. The amount of inflammation and even the healthiest body now, the amount of inflammation typically in humans compared to where it was 20 years ago is significantly higher. So the fact that we're not, you know, building, we're not maintaining our brain and our body, and our body is unhealthy. All of this, as well as our lifestyle and the fact that we maybe do have more stress in our life, all of this is actually creating more inflammation, more stress, the ability to detoxify our body because now we have more toxins in our environment that we're exposed to, more drugs that we take. And all of this is putting more stressors on our body. And so some of the toxins can cause problems to our genes. But more often than not, it's just our body's stress reaction to the toxins and to all of those things going on that actually is what affects the gene expression, and that's what produces the neurobehavioral issue.
Wow, that is really interesting. So you're saying, let me be clear on this, so you're saying computers are actually stressing our bodies and our brains, And this is causing an increased amount of inflammation in our bodies. Now, are you saying any kind of computer use? Are you, because some people get on there and for, you know, for fun, and but most of us, or a lot of us adults, get on the computer for work. Now, are you saying there is there a difference? You know, is or is it any computer use?
Yeah, no, it's not the computers themselves.
Okay.
It is two factors that I can see. One is, it's the fact that we're all sitting in front of computers all day, and that we are not moving anywhere near as much.
Got it.
Especially with young children. I mean, what we know is that at least 25 or 30% of four-year-olds are obese in the United States. That didn't exist. I mean, in the 70s, the level of obesity, of overweight obesity in kids and in teenagers was around 4 or 5%. Now we're talking at least 20%, maybe 30%.
Of four-year-olds?
4-year-olds, it's 25 to 30% of 4-year-olds are obese, not just overweight. Now, the only way, and I showed this in one of my first books, is that, you know, studies have shown with our own government that the only way a child gets obese is not because they're eating too much, it's because they're not moving their body. That typically, if a 4-year-old is going to move like a typical 4-year-old should move, it's almost impossible that they could get obese, even overweight, because they're so active, they're not eating while they're active, but then they're also burning so many calories when they're active. But so it's the fact that we're actually less physically active as a whole, and that we're also it's affecting our social communication with other humans. Right? Because we're more isolated.
Right.
Those factors. Now, the other factor is that video games, by their nature, the way that they're structured and the type of stimulus that they provide to the brain, actually do actually cause an imbalance in the brain, I believe, that can also increase our stress response and increase, you know, all of these health issues that we're seeing. So it's two things. It's really three things. One is that we're not moving our bodies. We're not socializing and interacting with other people. And the fact that video games themselves and some aspects of social media actually stimulate the left brain more than the right brain and can cause an imbalance, which is what we see in ADHD and autism and OCD and Tourette's and even schizophrenia.
Yeah. Now, can that do that if they're just on their phones all the time, regardless of playing games or not? You know what I'm saying? Or is it just the fact of being on the phone?
Yeah, it's really the nature of the way of the type of stimulus. The left brain responds to what we call very short-term reward-reinforced attention networks. So these are the networks that are also associated with obsessions and compulsions and all addictions. It's why right now video games are being called by many experts digital heroin, because they really affect our nervous system and our brain the same way as heroin and crack. They actually stimulate our reward networks and actually reinforce them and strengthen them, and they inhibit the other side of the brain, which tends to give us more long-term attention and allows us to not have addictions. So it's really the nature of the way video games are structured and the way some social media is structured. Anything where it's very quick, even some TV shows and even the way most cartoons are actually structured now, they're very quick. They're very fast. They give what we call very short-term reward bursts that actually stimulate dopaminergic networks in the left brain. So, you know, TV shows, some aspects of entertainment, video games, some aspects of social media, some of the YouTube videos, the way they're structured, all of those things have the potential of doing it. But it's not like if you're reading a book on a computer, you're studying on a computer, you're doing your homework on a computer, you're doing research on a computer. You know, that's not a problem as far as I'm concerned, other than it might affect your eyes a little bit because we don't have the same level of 3D depth. But other than that, and that you're sitting, it doesn't have the same effect as a lot of the entertainment part of the computer does.
You know, sometimes, and I guess I'm just a little old-fashioned, but I just like to pick the phone up and talk to somebody, you know. Now, texting is fine, and I do that, and messaging on social media, I do that some. That's fine, but sometimes my instinct is just like, let's just pick the phone up and talk, you know, because I like communicating the old-fashioned way. And by the time I'm trying to do texting, if there's a lot I want to say, sometimes I just don't want to text it because by the time I hit the wrong letter, and then I have to fix it, and then I want to shorten something to make it faster, and then the spell check, you know, disagrees with me. She wants to, you know, the spell check on my phone wants to say something different, and then I've got to change all that. It just takes me twice as long to get it out on text. I could have just said it in half the time, you know. And so, but now, I mean, that's fine if people want to text. And I do text. I text a lot. But again, I guess I'm just old-fashioned because sometimes I just want to talk. I just want to communicate the old-fashioned way. I just want to pick the phone up and talk.
And again, and these things we have to understand is that these things have a big impact on our brain. You know, the sound of our own and another's human voice is one of the most powerful stimulus to the brain. And, you know, in the old days, we were constantly talking to other people. And even with the development of the phone, we weren't seeing them, but at least we were hearing their voice, right? The fact that when we look at somebody and we look at their facial expression and we look at their body posture and we have what we call nonverbal communication, which, you know, is actually more important to humans than verbal communication, right? We always hear that 95% of what people say is nonverbal, right? Or what we hear. And so, you know, with phones and things like that, we remove some of that. But at least we had the sound of people's voices. Now, you know, this generation, you know, my own kids, they're in their 20s. They would much rather text than talk to anybody on the phone. And I agree with you. I'm like, hey, let me lift up the phone. And, you know, what you also mentioned there was very interesting. You know, there's something called a yawn reflex. And this is part of, and it goes back to, we use this in research. And this is used in a lot of autism and schizophrenia research that nonverbal communication is when we see somebody, you know, we mimic their facial expression. We tend to mimic one another. And that's how we know what somebody else is thinking or feeling. That when I look at somebody and I'm talking to them, their facial expression, their body posture, their tone of voice, I literally mimic them in my head. And even with my own facial expression, there were many studies that show that we actually adopt the same type of movements with micro movements in our face and in our body. And then I know, I say, when I feel that, I say, oh, I know what they're feeling because when I do that with my body and my face, I feel that. And there's something called a yawn response, which is, you know, literally, you know, that if you see somebody yawn, you yawn, right? Mm-hmm, it's right. It happens every time. It's a real response. And it is a normal human response. And it actually shows that your right brain, what we call mirror neuron networks, are actually working. Well, I believe we have a similar thing with phones, that when you see somebody lift up their phone to text, that we get that same urge to do the same thing, which goes back to the same as yawning. And so I think it is literally contagious. We know that yawning is contagious. If someone yawns, everybody in the room ends up yawning. And I think texting and lifting our phone up is the same thing, that if somebody lifts up their phone and starts looking at their phone and looking at their social media, checking their Facebook or texting, that everybody in the room will do that as part of the same thing as a yawn reflex.
Right. I've never thought about that, but I think you have a very good point there.
We are excited indeed to be celebrating our one-year anniversary here at America Out Loud. And we could not have done it without you. Well, in short order, we've become one of the fastest-growing podcast and talk radio networks in the world. For all the latest news, entertainment, your blogging, and now web TV, as we celebrate our one-year anniversary here, and we'll see you back at AmericaOutLoud.com. Well, I'm not sure why we take our health for granted, but I know that many of us do. Include me in that company. Recently, I had a couple of health scares that got my attention real quick. I started a new product called Healthy Cell. I took it for about 3 weeks, and man, I started to feel really good. I found myself sleeping better at night, had more energy in the day, and less stress and anxieties, and just feeling better overall. Well, with those kind of results, I knew I had to do something, so I reached to the company directly with a request to bring Healthy Cell back to America out loud, and here it is. Well, typically you'd pay $110 plus shipping and handling. Well, now you get it for just $79.99 for the monthly plan plus free shipping. That's right, they'll pick up the shipping and you pay just $79.99. Use the code OUTLOUD on HealthyCell.com or just click the banner on the front page of AmericaOutLoud.com.
You are listening to the Misdiagnosed Life podcast, and I'm your host, Beverly Butler, and we're, of course, on the America Out Loud Network, and I'm talking to Dr. Robert Melillo, and we're discussing these neurobehavioral problems in children, and, of course, Dr. Melillo works with these children every day, and he's got several books out on these problems, and he's also has a program called the Brain Balance Program, and we're going to talk about that here in just a little bit. But I wanted to talk to you a little bit more about these children. I wanted to ask, you know, many of these children with these neurological problems are very, very intelligent, and they're extremely they're extremely talented. Now, is there some reason? I mean, I know there's got to be a reason why, you know, especially like some autistic children, a lot of those are very, very smart in some ways, but yet they have these problems. Is there a higher percentage of these children in your research? It seems like it to me that are very smart or are very, very talented. Either they can just play the piano, you know, like Beethoven, or, you know, real good in sports or something like that, if they're able to understand enough to do that. Is there some connection with that and these problems, or am I just seeing things?
No, it actually is the reflection of the problem, and that's very good that you picked that up. And you're right, it's been recognized for years. And when I first started doing research on this, one of the things that jumped out at me was this concept of unevenness of skills that was present in all of these children, you know, going back, especially obviously in autism with Savant syndrome, but in ADHD and even in dyslexia. The earliest dyslexia research, or some of the earliest research that was done, was in the late 70s by a guy named Norm Gershwin, a very famous neurologist from Harvard. And he did seven autopsies on dyslexic adults. And one of the things that was noted was that they were all exceptional, like genius level in their visual spatial skills. So their art ability, their architecture, engineering, sports, athletics. And what they found was that there was, when they looked at their brains, area on the brain that is in the verbal area of the brain on the left side, which is normally bigger in most people, was actually bigger on the right side in those people, and was smaller on the left side, but yet these people all struggled with their verbal skills and with basic reading, which is what dyslexia is. So what we see is in autism and ADHD, we see the opposite. So this really goes to my work, which is really what my work is all about, that what are these problems? What is actually happening in the brain of someone with autism or ADHD or dyslexia? And the problem, as I said, comes back to something called functional connectivity, where connections in the brain, there are less connections in the brain in certain areas, but what we see is there are more connections in other areas. And primarily what we're seeing is there's a developmental imbalance in the brain where there are certain areas and certain networks in the brain that are more mature or more developed than we would typically see for their age. And they actually process information, and the connections are stronger in those areas than we would see typically in the average person. And yet in other areas on the other side of the brain, there are underdeveloped networks, and the communication between the two sides of the brain is deficient or underactive or underdeveloped in all the kids with these issues. So what we see, depending on whether they have, you know, strong overdeveloped networks in the left side of the brain and underdeveloped networks in the right side of the brain, that's what we see in autism and ADHD and OCD and Tourette's and schizophrenia. Whereas if we have an overdeveloped right side of the brain where we see advanced visual spatial skills, and underdeveloped left side of the brain, this is what we look at as dyslexia and most learning disabilities and processing disorders where kids struggle with basic academics and basic verbal skills. So the nature of the problem is this developmental imbalance. And what I've seen is that in all the kids that we work with, basically they are gifted. So the problem is that these kids are typically gifted in certain areas. They're stronger naturally in certain areas on one side of the brain. They're a little bit more left brain dominant or a little bit more right brain dominant. And because they're stronger in one side of the brain, typically, if the other side of the brain doesn't develop appropriately, they're more likely to end up with an imbalance. So what we see, and if you look at the parents and the siblings of these kids, they're usually, you know, very, very bright or extremely talented. And so this is what we're seeing, that imbalance, that unevenness of the skills is actually reflective of the actual problem. That is what autism is. That is what ADHD and dyslexia is.
It's just basically an imbalance in the brain.
Exactly.
Wow. Now, my daughter had some neurobehavioral problems, and many people know the story that's listening to the show. She had PANS or PANDAS. It's a certain type of OCD. I'm sure you know what that is. And she was like this. She was extremely, extremely talented in sports, basketball, tennis, you name it. I mean, she was really, really good. So this is really interesting, especially to me, because I can see that. You know, now I kind of understand why. And that kind of a thing. Now,
To speak on that, I've worked with a lot of people with PANDAS, and I've done, you know, significant research on it and published on it. My personal experience is that I've never seen a kid that had PANDAS, that developed that PANDAS, that didn't have a pre-existing brain imbalance, which is what I believe why they end up with that, why they have a leaky. Because to get something like PANDAS, which for your viewers, if they don't know that, PANDAS stands for Pediatric Autoimmune Neuropsychiatric Disorder Associated with Streptococcal Infection. Basically, it means that someone gets a strep throat, and after that, they can end up with OCD or Tourette's or ADHD or tics. We now know that it's not just strep throat. It's also things like mycoplasm, Lyme disease, and really now we know that anything that triggers the immune response maybe can do that, because what ultimately happens is you have to have a leaky gut, and then you have to have a leaky blood-brain barrier, and so that's all the things that need to lead up to it. So the reason why you have a leaky gut and a leaky blood-brain barrier is because of this imbalance in the brain, and then that leads to these antibodies getting across the brain and attacking an area of the brain called the basal ganglia, which is what ultimately causes PANDAS or PANS or what we call PITANS. So again, the brain imbalance and the talent that goes along with that is kind of indicative of why the person ended up with the PANDAS to begin with.
Okay, well, what does that have to do with the infections that they get? Or does it make the infections they get a lot worse? I mean, what comes first, the brain imbalance or the infection? Or do we know?
In my experience, it's the brain imbalance comes first, because everybody gets infections. Mm-hmm. Everybody is exposed to different autoimmune responses or food sensitivities or foods. But we don't all develop an infection. We don't all develop autoimmunity. We all don't develop food sensitivity or food allergy, right? So the idea is that we're all exposed to these foods. Why do we get these things? And there isn't really a genetic reason for it that we're aware of for the most part. So it means that there's something already that is affecting the body. And usually what it means is that we have to have a problem with our digestive system for that to exist and have a breakdown of the blood-brain barrier. So again, something has to pre-exist before the infection, but understand that the brain regulates our immune system. This is something that very few people, even most medical physicians, don't really understand. That, you know, the immune system and the hormone system can operate independent of the brain, but for it to operate optimally, the brain is what controls it. The left side of the brain activates the immune system, and increases the sensitivity of antibodies. And the right side of the brain suppresses our immune system, so we don't have an overactive immune system, and we don't develop, you know, autoimmune problems, which is what PANDAS is.
Right, right. Right. So you're saying that the right side of the brain is actually way more active in these children, which that suppresses, makes it, you know, where it suppresses the immune system more, and that is what's causing them to succumb to the infections that the average person can just fight off and go on. Is that what you're saying?
Well, it's actually one of two things. One is that they kids that have left brain weakness and strong right brains are prone to more infections. But because their immune system is more suppressed, they don't usually develop autoimmunity, which is really autoimmunity is really where the immune system is too strong, is overactive. So what they usually end up with are chronic infections, but they usually don't end up with autoimmunity, although that could potentially happen. But what more often happens is that when the right brain is decreased, so kids with ADHD or autism or Asperger's, those are kids that are more likely to get PANDAS type reactions, or they all have tics to some degree or another. And that's where where the immune system is suppressed. I mean, where it's not suppressed, it's hyperactive. Okay. Kids with autism are often referred to as Teflon kids, meaning they never get sick. But they all have to one degree or another things like food sensitivities, chemical sensitivities, gluten sensitivity, or autoimmunity like eczema. So it's really where their immune system is too strong and can't be shut off.
Oh, I see. Yeah, because then when these children with an overactive immune system, when they get these infections, it starts attacking the bacteria or the infection, but it does that too much and then starts attacking the organs also along
right.
with that. Is that correct?
Exactly.
Okay,
exactly.
That makes sense. That makes sense. I see. I hadn't thought about that. That's really neat. So really the root cause of these, according to your research, the root cause of these neurobehavioral problems is a brain imbalance. The right or the left is way more active than the other. And that is just, and basically it's what it's doing to the immune system that's really causing all these problems. Is that correct?
I believe that's probably the most common reason. Now, you know, these imbalances, ultimately, when you look at what PANDAS is, it's this infection and these antibodies are attacking an area of the brain that are creating then an imbalance in certain networks.
Okay.
Now, but again, the question is why these children and why not other children, right? Or why these adults and not other adults? And so I think that there is something that pre-exists. Now, there's a lot of things that can cause that type of neurological imbalance in that area of the basal ganglia. So there are kids that could have, you know, really immune compromises because of genetics, or they could have something where they have a problem with their digestive system and they have a leaky blood-brain barrier, or they've been exposed to toxins, or, you know, there are other things. Brain injury can cause it. But in my experience, when you're looking and you eliminate all of those other things, when there's no genetic mutations, when there's no history of this in the family, when there's no, you know, metabolic disease or genetic disorder or brain injury, the underlying thing that causes it is this imbalance in the brain, which causes an imbalance in multiple systems in the body. Because for you to have these problems exist, it doesn't just affect the immune system. It also has to affect the digestive system. Mm-hmm. Because according to some of my friends who are really great researchers and experts, to get a leaky blood-brain barrier, which is what you have to have before you can get PANDAS, you have to first have a leaky gut. So why would you have a leaky gut? So you have to have two things. You have to have a problem with your digestive system, and you have to have a problem and an imbalance in your immune system. Why would you have both of those? And the reason is because the brain is what regulates both of those.
So the brain is actually causing the leaky gut and the blood-brain barrier, the off balance of the brain.
Right. The imbalance in the brain leads to an imbalance ultimately in what we call the sympathetic and the parasympathetic system, which is the fight or flight or the rest and digest system. And so the sympathetic system is on when we're born. It's very active prenatally, and it's what basically, you know, makes our heartbeat really fast and what makes us, you know, breathe rapidly. And, you know, we all feel it whenever we're, you know, somebody jumps in front of our car, we hit our brake and, you know, our heart is racing, or whenever we exercise. But normally that should turn on in the adult in a short, for short level, and then calm down very quickly. But in children, that parasympathetic system, the part that calms our heart down and that, you know, allows us to digest our food, that produces enzymes in our gut and in our mouth and hydrochloric acid so we can digest our food, that increases blood flow to our gut, the parasympathetic system doesn't really develop appropriately for the first year. So over the course of the first year of life, that system, as the brain develops, will start to develop. And then as the brain matures, that part of the system matures so that, you know, we can, it slows our heart rate down and it allows us to digest food. It allows us to sleep through the night. So if the brain is unbalanced and immature in either the right side or the left side of the brain, that sympathetic or fight or flight system stays on at full force and never really gets turned off appropriately. And so what we see is their digestive system doesn't really work. And the digestive system, they have reduced blood flow to their stomach and to their gut lining. So they don't absorb vitamins, minerals, and nutrients. They have reduced enzymes, so they can't digest protein. They have reduced acid, so they can't break down food as well. And because of all of that, they end up with an altered pH balance, so they can develop yeast or fungus or bad bacterial infections in their gut. That can lead to release of toxins and inflammation. All of that leads to what we call a leaky gut, where the pores, normally the cells would be very tight and they only let fully digested proteins through. But because of the lack of blood flow and because of the secretions and other things going on in their gut, we see that the cells start to separate a little bit, and now larger undigested proteins can get through, like gluten or casein from dairy. And if we have an overactive immune system, with the right brain being deficient and the left side being strong, now the immune system, we develop antibodies very quickly against those foods. And now every time a child eats those foods, they get this inflammatory response. And that inflammation ultimately then can cause a breakdown of their blood-brain barrier. And then this can even cause inflammation in their brain that can last their whole life.
What would you suggest young couples do to prevent, so that they can be as healthy as they can be, to prevent these, or to do what, you know, all they can to prevent these problems from occurring in their children? Since, and I want you to talk a little bit more about what really happens to the, you know, with the mother and the child, you know, before she gets pregnant and during, you know, her pregnancy, that could cause these problems in children, and what can they do to try to prevent these problems in their children?
Well, that is what my whole third book was about. It's called Autism, the Scientific Truth About Preventing, Diagnosing, and Treating Autism Spectrum Disorders, and What Parents Can Do Now. And basically in it, first of all, I educate them as to what we've been talking about. What is autism? What are these neurobehavioral issues in the brain? And then what environmental factors and how environmental factors are actually doing this. But then I have a whole section, a 10-point program in the book, for people to be able to learn how to be able to identify these risk factors in their life and in their body, and then to, one step at a time, either to lower those risk factors or eliminate them, or to mitigate them. So I teach them, you know, all of the different things that they can do to actually get their body and prepare their body so that when it comes time to getting pregnant, that they are in the best shape that they can be, and that they've eliminated or reduced all of the most well-documented risk factors And so therefore, they would lower their risk significantly of having a child with an issue. We can't say for sure ever that we prevent anything, right? Because
right.
How do you know? We don't know what would have happened. But we can say that we can lower someone's risk, and we can measure that risk, and we can measure that we've lowered that risk. So, you know, my book, that I'm the first person to write a book on really how to prevent these things. And so that's what that book was all about. And then I also train doctors. Part of what I'm going to be in Rome, I'm leaving for Rome tonight, is because I train doctors and therapists all around the world on how to not only treat these issues in kids and in adults, but also a preconception program of how to identify and how to mitigate risk factors in a couple that is that wants to get pregnant.
Oh, well, that's really good, and that's really, really needed. And so now this information is in, tell the name of the book now that's in your autistic book so that people can know, they can go to Amazon and pick it up. What's the name of the book again? Tell them the name of the book again.
Autism, The Scientific Truth About Preventing, Diagnosing, and Treating Autism Spectrum Disorders and What Parents Can Do Now. It came out in 2013. All of my books are published by Penguin, who is the largest publisher in the world. And they're all available on Amazon. And they can go to my website also, drrobertmelillo.com, if they go to my website, or brainbalancecenters.com. All of those, they can get the book through there.
Okay. Now, tell us a little bit about your program, Brain Balance Program, and what that does for children.
Well, Brain Balance was, you know, ultimately we said that this imbalance in the brain is the problem. So the solution is to reverse that imbalance in the brain. Mm-hmm. And so it's different, though, the nature of the imbalance, because the brain is so complex. The nature of the imbalance is different in every single child or adult. And so the idea is I created a way of assessing, of creating a very comprehensive assessment to identify weaknesses and imbalances in motor skills, sensory detection and sensory processing, academic subject areas, cognitive skills, behavior, as well as being able to identify imbalances in the body and be able to put that into an assessment so that we could identify. That's in my first book, Disconnected Kids. There is a version of that in the book that parents can do that themselves. There are all these checklists and ways that they can assess their own child and even develop their own program. I get letters every day from around the world. My book has been translated into 8 languages, and I get people that are just using the book alone. So for $10, they can get the book and they can change their child's life. But the best way is we have Brain Balance Centers. I've created this program, and then this program was put into learning centers, and we have almost 130 learning centers across the United States. We'll work with almost 10,000 children and families this year.
Wow.
In most of those cases, we will completely eliminate these problems. What we said from the very beginning, what you said was, you know, preventing it is great, but the fact is most of the time the parents are dealing with this after the fact, and they're told that nothing can be done and there is no hope. Nothing could be further from the truth. We've worked with tens of thousands of kids now around the world and in the United States, and we have documented data. We've published research. There's a major study being done at Harvard right now on my work and what we do at Brain Balance, and it's showing dramatic changes in the child and in their brain. And what we see is that these problems can be completely corrected most of the time. That they're not a life sentence, but the average person out there dealing with these issues every day has no idea what these problems are.
Yeah. Well, that is very, it was giving me chills hearing you say that. This is fantastic. There's answers and there's solutions, and that's what my program is about. It's getting these answers and solutions to these problems and to all kinds of problems out there to the people, because they're, like your program, although it's known by a lot of people, but still most people are not aware of it. And because there's so many people out there that are just struggling and they don't have time to do the research and stuff, but there's a lot of things out there that really help people, and they're not as widely known as they need to be. Now, you say that you help people. Now, you're talking about you help kids with PANS or PANDAS and OCD and ADHD and autism. You're talking across the spectrum, right?
Well, you know, the kids with PANS and PANDAS, genetic disorders, things like that. I teach doctors who practice functional neurology or what we call functional medicine. And when you're dealing with PANDAS and you're dealing with a true immune problem, you really need to see a health professional.
But, yeah, that's what I was wondering.
Yeah.
That's what I was thinking.
And our centers are not. They're learning centers. So, you know, but what I will say is that, again, a lot of the kids, when they're also seeing a health professional, that they may have these imbalances in their brain as well. But mostly the kids that we work with in Brain Balance don't have any of these issues. Now, there's also confusion with autism because 10 to 15% of kids with autism have what's called syndromic autism, which means they're labeled with autism, but they really have a genetic syndrome like Fragile X or tuberous sclerosis or Landau-Kleffner or Down syndrome. And so even though they're labeled with autism, many people don't really consider that autism. They consider it a genetic disorder with autism-like symptoms. And that can be very confusing for families because these kids tend to be very, very severe. And so, you know, they truly have genetic issues. And so, therefore, we don't deal with kids that have, you know, the genetic issues. Those can be managed, again, by other health professionals. But what we're dealing with are kids that are, for the most part, very healthy. They don't have genetic mutations. They have imbalances in their brain that are affecting their ability to learn, either academically or behaviorally. And those are the kids that we work with. They don't have brain injury. They don't have health problems per se. They may have food sensitivities, but again, but we don't deal with their health or their medical problems. But when we get their brain working, most of those things go away on their own.
Okay. Yeah. So I'm glad you brought that up. So if a child is sick, of course, they always need to go to a doctor probably a functional doctor would probably be better, but they need to go to a doctor, of course. But it would probably be a good idea to work with your program or at least be tested, because then they could use the Brain Balance program to help balance out their brain, which would help what their doctor's doing to work even better.
Yeah, and even more so, if they balanced out their brain early on, they wouldn't have a lot of those issues. I don't think they would get PANS or PANDAS or leaky gut or any of those things if the brain is balanced. Yeah. So I think that it would prevent those things.
Yeah. So if parents notice some of these symptoms in their child before they actually get sick, it would be good to take them to the Brain Balance program, or at least look at your book. And the book is Disconnected Kids. They could do the questionnaire themselves,
right?
So that they can, if they can catch the brain imbalance early and get that fixed, then maybe they can avoid some of these problems. Now, let's briefly go over this list of symptoms that parents need to look for to detect, to have an idea of if a child maybe has a left and right brain disconnect. What are some of those symptoms that parents can look for?
Yeah, there are two things that typically jump out that we hear from almost every parent that we work with. One is that most of these kids have some issue with their developmental milestones. And this is a big confusion because most people are also told that that doesn't matter. But it really does matter, and it matters significantly. So, meaning that if they don't roll over when they're supposed to at 3 to 5 months, if they roll over to one side and not the other, if they don't crawl in a normal way, if they have an unusual way of crawling, if they drag one leg, or if they roll over, or if they're delayed in crawling, or if they skip crawling altogether, if they're delayed in walking, even beyond 13 months. My experience says that if a child isn't walking by the end of 13 months, they're delayed. They should be walking at 12 months. And even at the end of 13 months, they may still be delayed. But if they're delayed in speaking, if they're delayed in anything, if they don't develop, you know, handedness, if they don't have a dominant hand, if the parent doesn't really see that they have a handedness by the end of two, if they're not really speaking, by 1 year of age, 3 to 5 words. I mean, all of these things. I've really never seen a child that hasn't had some sort of milestone disruption. Most of the many parents don't know it because they go to the pediatrician and the pediatrician says, well, it doesn't really matter. Or they're told that, you know, no, that's within normal limits. And, you know, it may be, but I don't really consider it normal limits, right? So we're told that a child, if they walk, you know, up to 16 months, that's normal. For me, that's definitely delayed. The other thing is that many of the parents, as you know, they know that their kid has this unevenness of skills. They notice that they're really good at certain things or they're better at certain things or they do certain things early. And yet, you know, they really struggle in another area. And it's confusing. You know, you get a lot of kids who have these right brain delays and maybe end up with an Asperger's or ADHD label. And they start out and they're really good word readers and they're really good at their memory for details is great. And they may speak early and then they get to, you know, fourth, fifth grade and they have problems with their nonverbal communication. They have poor social skills. They may have poor gross motor skills. They don't really understand the big picture and parents don't understand it because they had a kid that looked like they were going to be a genius. On the other hand, like you said, you get kids that are these incredible artists early on or great athletes. Or really good with music and, you know, they struggle in basic reading and they can't learn in school. So that unevenness of skills is another thing that stands out and shows parents that there is the source of the problem is most likely this brain imbalance. And the earlier they can get to it, the earlier they can eliminate it, the earlier their child can go on to being really a gifted kid, which is what these kids almost always are.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's very good, and that is, and I highly suggest people to get to look at your books and to like the Disconnected Kids. I know is I've got that one. That's a very good one, and all of your other books are very, very good. What do people need to do to get to find out more information? Just go to your website to kind of keep up more with what you're doing and some of the latest research.
Yeah, they can go to my website, drrobertmelillo.com, or they can check me out on Facebook under Dr. Robert Melillo or Twitter under, and that's Dr. Rob Melillo, at Dr. Rob Melillo. I'm active on social media as well, but I usually stand when I'm doing them. You know, they can contact me in those ways. They can go to my website or they can go to Brain Balance Centers.com. We have a beautiful website that really will explain you know, what is going on and we have a lot of information like research and articles and testimonials and things like that, that parents can go on and they can find out more information.
Okay. Yeah. And, thank you so much, Dr. Melillo. I really appreciate the work that you're doing. And, again, folks, if you want to find out more information, you can go to these websites he mentioned. They will be listed on the show notes at the bottom of the podcast on the website. And thank you for listening. This is Beverly Butler, and you've been listening to the Misdiagnosed Life podcast and talk radio on the America Out Loud Network.